Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
What I wanted to do is give you a little bit of context for what you will have seen in the news, and then I'll actually hand over to Basil to tell you a little bit more about what we are going to do with the proceeds. So during our investor day in December in New York, we spent time showing you the progress that we're making in our e-commerce businesses, and in particular we showed you how we've delivered excellent returns on our investments in e-commerce to date. So the strong progress that we've seen actually gives us the confidence to broaden our ambitions in the segment. Now, e-commerce revenue growth in our most recent reporting period accelerated to 38% year on year. We also saw a significant reduction in losses in the developing businesses, and we also saw more businesses turning profitable. And more specifically, if I go through the main e-commerce segments, our classifieds business, which is a global leader in the space, increased the number of profitable businesses and also continued scaling throughout. And that resulted in the segment turning profitable as a whole, excluding our U.S. investments in Letgo. Second, in PayU, and much like in classifieds before it, they are consolidating a number of different businesses and platforms under a single brand and technology. And that allows the segment to drive efficiencies quickly, but it's also growing its top line fast. And to give you an indication, it actually saw transaction volumes grow by 75% year on year in the last reporting period. So third, in online food delivery, we're really seeing unprecedented growth. And it's driven by a large number of meal occasions and the fact that there are significant consumer needs that get served really well by the business. It also has very strong network effects. And finally, in our B2C segment, Flipkart, eMAG, and Takealot have all accelerated growth over the last year and at the same time gained share versus their competitors. So these businesses are showing potential for strong returns. We got in early in these businesses at good prices, and we built sizable market leaders here. So with this as a backdrop, going forward, we want to continue to accelerate building our e-commerce segments. More specifically, we want to accelerate growth. We want to also expand into adjacencies where relevant, and we want to bring businesses to a self-funding status faster. Now, to enable this further development, we thought the market was conducive to raise funds now. So most of you will have seen the announcement today that we've completed the sale of some 190 million Tencent shares by way of an accelerated offering. So that's approximately 2% of the issued share capital of Tencent, and this reduced our stake from 33.2% to 31.2%. The transaction, it closed at 405 Hong Kong dollars per share, and it yielded us $9.8 billion in net proceeds. So up until today, we had not sold a single Tencent share since the original investment in 2001. And that's because we believe that Tencent is really one of the very best growth enterprises in any industry in the world. So we remain firmly committed to the company. It's managed by probably the most exceptional team in technology in the world today. And after today's transaction, we are committed to not selling any further Tencent shares for the next 3 years. So with that as context, I wanted to hand you over to Basil, who will tell you more about how we'll use the proceeds. Basil?
Thanks, Bob. Hello, everyone. So folks, Bob mentioned and covered, and we also covered it in some detail at our recent Investor Day, that we're increasingly focused in the core segments of classifieds, fintech, and food delivery. Then you'll remember that we've also mentioned that we're making selective investments in our ventures division to uncover the next driver of growth. As we build confidence here, we scale these investments further. This approach is building valuable businesses. Based on current analyst valuations and funds invested to date, the blended IRR for the existing assets on the books is 23%. That's an exceptional number. Given the strong performance to date, we are therefore increasingly confident of our ability to scale our segments further. In that spirit, you will have noticed that in the current financial year, we've already invested some $2.1 billion in M&A. And we're already seeing excellent returns on those investments, in many cases ahead of the blended 23% that I mentioned earlier. So the funds from the sale will allow us to expand geographically into complementary adjacencies and also to pursue further consolidation opportunities as and when they arise. As Bob mentioned, our classified segment is profitable and the remaining segments are scaling fast and are all on a path to profitability. Then, as you're aware, we invest typically in a structure where the founders retain a significant holding in the businesses, and this shows absolute alignment with us. In order to maintain flexibility, we allow founders to put these shares to us while also retaining a right to call these shares. In settling these obligations, we also allow the founders the opportunity to receive and also for us to settle Naspers shares. Now, given the widening holding company discount, we don't think it's appropriate to dilute our shareholders, and therefore we don't intend to issue shares to settle any puts and calls going forward. We will thus use a portion of these proceeds to settle these obligations as and when we decide to exercise them. At current valuations, the total investment is estimated at about $2.4 billion. This figure will grow as we continue to scale the businesses. Then continuing on this theme, we also no longer will issue new shares necessary to settle our share options for employees, removing a further dilution impact on our shareholders. Instead, we will go out into the market and purchase the shares needed for share options. So folks, in summary, this transaction will create sufficient headroom to continue to expand our core segments and also settle found and put calls. As mentioned, the focus is in our core area of expertise. The flexibility is particularly important given our commitment to a three-year standstill on selling Tencent shares. As always, and as the track record has shown, we'll remain disciplined about valuations and focused on delivering excellent returns to you. We aim to build on the improving track record to date. So, folks, with that, I'd now like to hand back to the operator, and we'll open the session for questions.
The first question comes from Cesar Taron of Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
Yes, hi, everyone. Thanks for the call and for the opportunity to ask questions. I have two questions. You mentioned in your press release that classifieds could be a potential use of cash, but as you also said, let go classifieds is already break-even. So should we conclude that it either means M&A in classifieds or increasing your stake in assets which you don't fully control, like Avito? And then the second question is your net cash position is now very comfortable. Does it make it more likely that you unbundle assets which were previously needed to fund the group, like PayTV, for example? Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for your questions. I will answer the first one, and I'll hand over to Basil for the second question. So you are correct. Our classifieds business in aggregate, except for LetGo, is profitable. When we talk about additional investments here, it can either be M&A. For example, we bought a company called AutoTrader in South Africa, which we know has strong synergies and growth potential. It's a great example of an adjacency that we bought to M&A. There are also potential other areas, as you said, where we have minorities
that over time may want to exit where we'll use funds, and in some cases those minorities are significant. Avito was actually a good example of those. Basil, can you answer the second question?
Basil, you may be on mute. Unfortunately, Basil has dropped off. He's going to have to redial back in, sir, unfortunately.
Okay, no problem. I'll answer the question so we can continue. Now, so I think the capital that we now have raised to reinforce the balance sheet does give us more flexibility. But I think what doesn't change compared to before is we are really diligent on making sure that the assets we have, we believe in significant return potential for them going forward, or value appreciation potential. If they fit the bill, then they stay within the portfolio. If not, we look for a chance to exit. What it does do is maybe reduce that dependency on certain cash flows from certain businesses, which make that consideration even simpler.
The next question comes from J.P. Davis of J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. Two questions from my side. Firstly, I'd just like to revisit the commentary Basil made in his opening remarks. Hopefully give him time to dial in. Otherwise, Bob, maybe you can take it. Just on the puts and calls, just wanted to clarify that's $2.4 billion. And if those are taken out of the way, does that actually impact your minority positions in those companies, or is it just removing option structures? So just a point of clarification. Then secondly, just if Bob, you could provide a little bit more context around the motivation for doing this deal now. I guess all of what you introduced at the beginning was laid out at the capital markets, and at that point you communicated it was, you know, the business plan was self-funded. Clearly, this seems a very big decision to sell Tencent. So is it a case maybe that there are opportunities that didn't exist back in December that now exist now, or is it a case that you're just being opportunistic on the valuations Tencent is at? Maybe provide a little bit more context around the timing and the motivation for the deal if possible. Thank you.
Yeah, no, sure. I'll start with your first question. So the number is correct. It's $2.4 billion U.S. dollars. Now, it's not a given that minorities, and it's typically in a situation where we are the majority owner of the asset, and there are founders typically in there who still hold a minority position. So it is not the case that necessarily these founders will want to exit, and in many cases we end up working together for a much longer period of time than what the initial put or call window is. And typically, what we've seen, for example, is also a possibility is that our founders will want to sell some of their shares but stay in for another portion. So the total in aggregate value of puts and calls that can be sold this way is that $2.4 billion. But it doesn't mean all of that will happen, but what the other side of the equation is that over time that number will grow. On your second point is, look, we saw that the market was conducive to execute this transaction now. There have been opportunities to grow these segments, and we saw those in December. I would say our both our confidence level and our outlook on new opportunities are very strong at this point in time, which drove us to execute this transaction now. I don't know if Basil has anything to add to that.
Yeah.
I think Basil's back.
Just one addition. Clearly, if we do actually write the check, it's for more shares in the company, right, with regards to the puts and calls. So it's not just a check. It's actually four more shares in the company.
Okay, thanks very much, guys. Just one quick follow-up. Just in terms of the motivation for the deal, I mean, is there any reason to believe that there are, you know, specific deals in the pipeline that need to be executed on in the near term that was a motivation for the deal getting done? Or is it sort of a broader, a broader strategy that's in play here?
No, it's very much the latter. So there are no specific large M&A opportunities on the table that drive us to do this now. It doesn't mean we won't do anything specific, but it's not the rationale here.
Thank you.
The next question comes from Garrett Heldenes of Investec.
Hello, everyone. Thanks very much for the call. I just wonder if you can clarify two points for me. Just the when we can get some guidance on the tax impacts of this transaction. I might have missed that, so apologies if I have. And the second, you've been quite specific about no buybacks to date. Is that something which is still on the table if the share price moves and the discount widens further, or is it simply never to be discussed? Thank you very much.
Yeah, if okay, I'll ask Basil if Basil is still online to answer the question around the tax implication. Otherwise, I can give the directional answer to it, and I can certainly cover the buybacks. I think Basil is having some phone trouble, so let me start, and Basil, if you get back on, you can chime in. So when it comes to tax, there's the tax structure is obviously dependent on who buys, who sells over time, and the specific implications, you really have to follow the details of the tax laws to understand them. We are a big taxpayer in South Africa. We pay about 8 billion rands in tax in the last financial year, and I think over time, as a result of the capital freed up here, obviously this will transform into a longer term dividend stream, which will be there will be a dividend tax attracted by that. While specifically now, when these shares are sold to South African investors, there will be a direct tax, capital gains tax of 22%.
Hello, thank you. Yeah, that's great. The other one was just a question on the buyback.
The lines between Hong Kong and South Africa have gone really bad. Apologies, everyone.
Okay. All right. Okay, then maybe I'll start by answering the question on share buybacks. So I think it's good that we clarify that. So we have no principal objections against share buybacks. I think the situation we're in as a group is we are actually seeing more opportunities than we're generating cash, right? So we're consuming cash at this point in time. And given that context, we don't think it's the right time for us to do share buybacks. When we see that situation turn around, and as a group we're cash generative, then buybacks are firmly on the table for us to consider. Okay.
Well, thank you very much for the clarification. Thank you. Bye.
The next question comes from Chris Grunberg of UBS.
Oh, hi, guys. Just two quick questions, if I may. On the puts and calls, apologies if I missed this earlier, but I wondered if you could break out the $2.4 billion in any detail at all in terms of either division or function, maybe not specific businesses, but also just clarify, when you say founders, does this also include some of the partner investors that you have in some of those businesses? Again, apologies, this is just a detailed clarification. And then a second question for you, just in terms of the video entertainment business. As one of the earlier questions pointed out, you are now less reliant on that from cash generation, and you have previously talked about that as being something that I guess is going to happen in the next couple of years anyway. Can you give us any help in terms of how we would think about what might be a consideration for that business in terms of an unbundling? And specifically, I guess, there again, tax requirements or what the Saab would think of what you might look to do with that business. Again, I don't necessarily need specifics, but just some high-level thoughts would be helpful. Thanks.
Sure. Let me start on the puts and calls. So the $2.4 billion is spread across our main segments, where classified stakes, just off the top of my head, the majority of that. There are also a few in our B2C business, most notably EMAG and Take a Lot. You asked also a further question on does it include co-investment partners? Yeah, in a number of cases, it actually does include co-investment partners and not only founders. So the bulk would be in classifieds, a good chunk in B2C, and then spread over some other segments, and it would include partners in a number of cases. So in terms of video entertainment, I think I think there are possibilities if the board decides that we want to find a different home for that business to do so. So I think that is possible. It's not straightforward. There are a number of considerations around, for example, license conditions and our Patuminati shareholders that would have to be considered. And I think whether it's the right thing for the group to consider a spin out, it's really one of the options the board will consider going forward. And when decisions have been made, we'll communicate them to you as soon as possible.
That's really helpful.
Your question?
That's very helpful indeed. Thank you. Just one clarification on the first one. You mentioned that the 2.4 obviously classifieds takes the bulk of that. On the specifics, I'm assuming therefore that Schibsted is the counterparty in a number of these puts and calls. Would the bulk of that be taken up by OLX Brazil?
I don't think that's the bulk of that. No, I think it may well be in there, but I don't think it's the bulk of it. Avito is a good piece of it.
Avito is a good piece. Okay, that's really helpful. Thank you, Bob.
The next question comes from David Lefel of Deutsche Bank.
Yes, good morning. Excellent. Great. Thank you guys for taking the time. You continue to highlight the 24% IRR on your investments. Are you going to continue to share the information and maybe continue to provide us information in the annual report so we can track these assets and, you know, back out the returns on specific assets? I mean, right now, I don't know how one gets to that 24%.
No, it's a good question. I think what we wanted to do, and we did during our investor day, is give you that insight. And I don't think we can provide it on a semi-annual basis, for example, because it's actually a very significant amount of work. We need to have it separately audited. We need to have investment banks involved to make sure that everything is perfectly comparable. But we do have the intention of providing you with a return on investment view on a regular basis.
Okay, and will that be done by business units or something so that we can get a little bit better idea of the different areas are performing as expected or not?
So I think one of the things you will have seen in New York. Sorry, Basil?
Sorry, Bob, I was going to step in and say, look, I think we do provide an aggregate. It gets tricky when we start to give it by business or by company, because then that puts us at a real disadvantage when dealing with competitors and dealing with strategic alternatives and so forth. So we'll continue to do it in the aggregate and in a similar form to what we've done at the Investor Day.
Okay, understood. It's just, you know, if you're going to be putting, you know, several billion dollars to work over the next few years, it just makes it easier as an investor to track the ongoing success of the company by knowing, you know, a little bit more granularity.
Sure.
But thank you, I understand.
What you will be able to do, and you will have seen, is we've actually increased the disclosure around the financial performance of the revenues and the profits of the underlying segments. So you now have that by segment, and you'll be able to track that. And, of course, growth in profits and cash flows means growth in valuation. So I would encourage you to focus on those now numbers and the progress that we make there.
Thank you. Thanks.
The next question comes from Ken Rumpf of Jefferies. Ken Rumpf, your line is open. You are able
Hi.
To ask your question.
Sorry, I was muted.
No,
hi, guys. Sorry for that. Okay, a couple of questions. One is, should we take the sort of 3-year lock-in on Tencent as being a kind of guide to the period over which you might deploy this money, the cash you earn, and so on? Can you give any indication of how you might divide the money by sectors, venture, and the sort of three main business lines. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, maybe I'll ask Basil to answer the first question. Now he seems to be back online with a good line. Now I'll have a go at answering the second one.
Thanks, Bob. Folks, again, apologies for the technical trouble, but I'm back. So, look, it's very hard to forecast and predict M&A, right? As everyone knows, we look at 600 to 700 opportunities a year. We close only a fraction of those, and we remain very disciplined in what we look for and where we allocate our capital. So the only thing I can point to is that over the last year, we've deployed $2.1 billion worth of capital. So we'll continue to chase, but we'll remain disciplined. And the pace will really depend on how quickly we can uncover great returning opportunities.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Basil. And I'm afraid you're going to get a very similar answer for your second question. So what I can say is that of the capital that we freed up here, the vast majority will be deployed across classifieds, payments, and food delivery, rather than at other segments. So this is where you will see our continued focus. That will not change. And within those, it is really very much driven by, do we like the exact business model we encounter? Do we like the founder? Or do we like the organic opportunity? And do we believe we can drive an excellent return for you? And if we are happy about that return, we'll deploy the capital. And if not, we will not.
Okay. I suspect the answer to a follow-up might be the same, but any indication of whether you it sounds more like private than public investments, but you could comment. Finally, I think in view particularly of some of the press reports, it might be interesting to have your comment on the precise timing of this. It's kind of been read as a reaction to a bad quarter, which I think is probably a mistake that this wasn't thought of overnight, but you might want to comment on that.
Yeah, I'd be very happy to comment on that. So it has absolutely nothing to do with that, right? So I think we also indicate by a three-year lockup that we have a tremendous amount of confidence in Tencent, obviously still a very large exposure to Tencent, and the timing has absolutely nothing to do with recent results. And we believe that Tencent is the most exciting investment opportunity there is at scale. And that hasn't changed at all. I think you asked a further question around, I think we've invested not very often at scale in public companies, although we have invested recently in more shares in Delivery Hero because we think it's an exceptional opportunity. But I think you'll see, in general, us more focused on private than public. But again, if we see an exceptional return profile for our shareholders, we will go for it.
Ken, does that answer your question?
You lost me again. Thanks very much.
Thank you. The next question comes from John Kim of Deutsche Bank.
Hi, everybody. Kind of short technical questions here. Just a clarification. On the M&A year-to-date, I heard $1.2 billion. Is that correct?
No. John, it's 2.1 billion.
Sorry, 2.1. Okay, and that figure includes the secondary or the additional stake in Delivery Hero? Question mark.
Yes, it does.
Okay, yes. Great. With the proceeds, you'd mentioned a present value of 2.4 billion for the put call option structures. Is it fair to assume that most of the 10 billion capital raise will stay offshore? I.e., you don't see a bulk of the investment opportunity necessitating a South African domicile?
We look for opportunities across the world and we'll allocate capital in the markets where we find them. And if that's in South Africa, we'll also allocate capital to South Africa.
It's a bit of an open question, but $10 billion or call it a net figure of $7 billion plus gives you a fair bit of latitude that your organic cash flow has not allowed you. Does this affect your thought process in the sense of larger deals, larger transactions, transformative moves in industries rather than than maybe what's been executed the last two or three years. Effectively, the market's gotten bigger. The venture funds have gotten bigger. The private rounds have gotten bigger. So would it not make sense that you'd be placing bigger bets? Thank you.
Yeah, maybe I can have a go at answering that. So our intention is not to change our approach, right? I think in the past when we've seen big transformative opportunities that were quite expensive, say like Avito or Step Up there, we have taken those opportunities. I think Deliver Hero is another example of a large opportunity that we have very strong belief in that we've taken. So I don't think that posture will change. We are pretty sort of traditional and diligent and careful around spending our shareholders' money, and that most certainly won't change.
The next question comes from Zafar Rizzi of Harding Loevner.
Thank you. So, frankly, as shareholders, we've been disappointed by the lack of an announcement on share buybacks. And at the analyst investor day back in December, management sounded pretty frustrated about the discount to Tencent. And as growth opportunities go, you've mentioned Tencent is one of the best opportunities. And to the extent your stock is tied to it, why not allocate at least a portion of the proceeds towards buying back your own shares?
Yeah, I appreciate the question, but I think we've answered it previously. So we do think about share buybacks, but given the profile we're at, where we have more opportunities than our cash flow provides, we don't think it's the right thing to do.
Okay, and then a follow-up for Basil, which is about the tax implications. I think Basil got dropped off and the tax implications were being discussed. So Basil, if you could add any more color on the tax side.
Sure. Thanks. So, look, the $9.8 billion are the net proceeds, so that's what actually hits our books, and that's what that's what will be reflected on the balance sheet at the end of March. In terms of tax, any shares that were purchased by South African shareholders as part of the offering, there's a 22% tax on the gain there, and we'll need to compute that. We're still going through that math. And then, of course, as and when we make distributions to our shareholders over time, there's a withholding tax on those distributions of 20% for foreign shareholders. And then the last point is when South African shareholders sell their shares and the shares appreciate, they will be liable for capital gains tax. Generally, South African companies across the board, no matter what the company, who hold more than 10% of a foreign company are not subject to tax on capital gains. And that's a general rule for all South African companies.
Got it.
The next question comes from Kevin Madison of Avio Research.
Hi, thanks for the question. Just to do with the amount, so you've raised $10 billion. Just what's your thinking there in the context that on one hand, you said you're not going to be issuing any more shares, and on the other hand, you're locking up for 3 years, and maybe just a bit of color on those 3 years. So why not $5 billion or, say, $20 billion, given the lockup that you agreed to? Maybe, again, just a bit of color around that lockup. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe I can start there. So there's two reasons why we wanted to communicate that lockup. First of all, we want to make it crystal clear that our confidence and trust in Tencent's further potential has not changed at all, right? So we are confident giving that standstill. The other consideration for us is we don't want to create overhang in Tencent shares. That's not good for Tencent. It's also not good for us. And we believe that with a sale of this magnitude, we have the flexibility to execute on a higher ambition level that we're confident about.
Okay, so you have enough of a cushion in that for your current investment plans. Is that another way of looking at it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so we believe, look, it's hard to predict the future, but we believe we do.
Okay. Thank you.
And maybe to add, Kevin, as we deliver more profits and more cash flows, we'll be able to take on more debt. So we have flexibility.
The next question comes from Andrea Polis of Morgan Stanley.
Hi, good afternoon. I have two questions, please. During the intro remarks, Basil, you mentioned that you'd be looking at geographical expansion, adjacencies, and consolidation within the key categories. What do you mean by adjacencies? Can you give us a little bit more color there? And then the second question is around the discount again. I mean, it seems like so far, you know, up until the latest transaction, the discount remains stubbornly at close to 40% on our sum of the parts. You did talk about sort of some potential technical actions that you could take in order to drive this discount to close, in addition to the underlying performance of the businesses, like potentially and secondary listing. I mean, a buyback you've already discussed. Anything else that, you know, 6 months down the line, we're still seeing the same discount, you think you could do to actually sort of drive this discount to close? Thanks.
Sure. And let me answer your first question, and then I'll ask Basil to address the second one. So on adjacencies, I think it's always the best way to illustrate it with examples, right? So in our core payments business, we've made a number of investments in credit. Creditech is an example. We made some smaller ones as well, where we know basically on the strength of that core payment business, you can leverage first the merchant relation, but also your data to provide a credit product that we know is a great source of margin. So that's a specific example. Another specific example for example, classifieds is we bought a company in the Emirates that buys that gives you cash for your car if you want to get rid of it quickly. Very, very closely related to our core classifieds business. And again, a good source of margin and profits going forward. So those are adjacent businesses that have strong synergies with our core of classifieds and payments that we think will help us create value over time. Did that answer your question? First question?
Thanks. Yeah, that does. Thanks.
Thanks. And then to deal with your second question. Yeah, look, there's many things that drive a discount, some in our control, some not. Clearly what we need to do is keep driving these businesses, allocating capital smartly, driving the business to scale, getting to profitability, getting to cash flow. And then we've also spoken about looking at several other structural options. And that work is ongoing. There's lots of detailed work being done there. As and when we see it, clear path, we will go to our board and get the necessary approvals, and then we'll come and tell you what we plan to do. So we're not done, and there's still lots more work for us to do here.
Ladies and gentlemen, unfortunately, due to time constraints, we have only time for one more question, and that is from Jacques Conradi of Peregrine Capital.
Hi, good afternoon, Bob and Basil. I've just got a few questions. Firstly, I just want to make really sure on the tax because it's quite a big number. The specific 22% tax that you mentioned, capital gains tax, that repayable immediately, only applies on the small portion of 10 cent shares that would have been purchased by SA investors. Am I understanding that correctly?
I understand. That's correct.
All right, perfect. Then, I mean, I think we've spoken about buyback once or twice. I just want to ask one more question around that. Given both the substantial discount the shares traded at over the last 6 months and, I guess, the very, very good portfolio of assets that you control, I think most of your shareholders believe that buybacks would generate a very high IRR on money invested. So I guess as shareholders, we just want to know, will you be comparing new investment opportunities with the potentially very high IRR you could have obtained spending the money on buybacks?
Yeah, so I'll give you an initial answer. I think we said that we do consider all options when we do investments, including buying back our own shares. The reality is we are not generating more cash than we consume, which basically means that the moment you you buy back shares, yes, you generate a one-off significant return, but you forgo the option of using that cash for a perpetually generating strong return investment otherwise. And our board is strongly convinced that given the cash consuming profile we're in, that's not the right thing to do.
All right, and maybe just one final question. You're building some really nice businesses of scale here, and I guess with this cash, you can build them to be even more substantial. Can we assume that the end game for many of these assets would be an eventual value crystallization for shareholders? I mean, some examples would be, let's say, unbundling pay TV directly onto the SA Exchange or eventually listing classifieds or in Amsterdam. Is that the end goal in many of these investments to get the value to shareholders eventually?
You know, I think you give two good examples of structural options that we are considering that we think can help to unlock value and close the discount. Again, we're working through some of these quite carefully to make sure we make the right long-term call, but those are examples of the things we're actively looking at.
Okay, great. Thanks, Bob.